Good evening. Welcome to the Bookshelf. This is Mike Aleman. We continue tonight with The Death of Ivan Ilyich by Leo Tolstoy. Ivan Ilyich is struggling to figure out how he can live knowing that he's going to die. Ivan Ilyich was somewhat late getting home to dinner. He conversed cheerfully after dinner, but for some time could not bring himself to go to his room and work. At last he went to his study and immediately set to work. He read through some cases, concentrated, but was constantly aware that he had put off an important private matter which he would attend to once he was through. When he finished his work, he remembered that his private matter involved some thoughts about his cecum. But instead of devoting himself to them, he went into the drawing room to have tea. Guests were there talking, playing the piano, and singing. Among them was the examining magistrate, a desirable fiancé for their daughter. Ivan Ilyich, as Praskovya Fyodorovna observed, was more cheerful that evening than usual. But never for a moment did he forget that he had put off that important business about his cecum. At 11 o'clock he took leave of everyone and went to his room. Ever since his illness, he had slept alone in a little room adjoining his study. He went in, undressed, and picked up a novel by Zola. But instead of reading, he lapsed into thought. And in his imagination, that longed-for cure of a cecum took place. Absorption, evacuation, and a restoration of normal functioning. Yes, that's the way it works, he told himself. One need only give nature a hand. He remembered his medicine, raised himself, took it, then lay on his back, observing what a beneficial effect the medicine was having, how it was killing the pain. Only I must take it regularly and avoid having anything that could have a bad effect on me. I feel somewhat better already, much better. He began probing his side. It was not painful to the touch. I really can't feel anything there. It's much better already. He put out the candle and lay on his side. His cecum was improving, absorbing. Suddenly he felt the old familiar dull gnawing pain. Quiet, serious, insistent. The same familiar bad taste in his mouth. His heart sank. He felt dazed. My God, he muttered. Again, and it will never end. And suddenly he saw things in an entirely different light. A cecum? A kidney, he exclaimed inwardly. It's not a question of a cecum or of a kidney, but of life and death. Yes, life was there, and now it's going, and I can't hold on to it. Why deceive myself? Isn't it clear to everyone but me that I'm dying, that it's only a question of weeks, days, perhaps minutes? Before there was light, now there is darkness. Before I was here, now I am going there. Where? He broke out in a cold sweat. His breathing died down. All he could hear was the beating of his heart. I'll be gone. What will there be then? Nothing. So where will I be when I'm gone? Can this really be death? No, I don't want this. He jumped up, wanted to light the candle, groped for it with trembling hands, dropped the candle and candlestick on the floor, and sank back on the pillow again. Why bother? It's all the same, he thought, staring into the darkness with wide open eyes. Death. Yes, death. And they don't know and don't want to know and have no pity for me. They're playing. Through the door of his room, he caught the distant, intermittent sound of a voice and its accompaniment. It's all the same to them, but they'll die too. Fools. I'll go first, then they. But it will be just the same for them. Now they're enjoying themselves, the beasts. His resentment was choking him. He felt agonizingly, unspeakably miserable. It seemed inconceivable to him that all men invariably had been condemned to suffer this awful horror. He raised himself. Something must be wrong. I must calm down, think it all through from the beginning. And he began thinking. Yes, the beginning of my illness. I banged my side, but I was perfectly all right that day and the next. It hurt a little, then got worse, then came the doctors, then the despondency, the anguish, then more doctors, and all the while I was moving closer and closer to the abyss. Had less and less strength, kept moving closer and closer, and now I've wasted away, haven't a spark of life in my eyes. It's death. Yet I go on thinking about my cecum. I think about how to mend my cecum, whereas this is death. But can it really be death? Once again, he was seized with terror. He gasped for breath, leaned over, began groping for the matches, pressing his elbow for support on the bedside table. It was in his way, and it hurt him. He became furious with it, pressed even harder, and knocked it over. And then, breathless, in despair, he slumped down on his back, expecting death to strike him that very moment. Just then the guests were leaving. Praskovya Fyodorovna was seeing them off. Hearing something fall, she came in. "What is it?" "A nothing. I accidentally knocked it over." She went out and came back with a candle. He lay there, breathing heavily and rapidly like a man who has just run a mile, and stared at her with a glazed look. "What is it, Jean?" Nothing. I knocked it over." "What's the point of telling her? She won't understand." And she probably did not understand. She picked up the stand, lit the candle for him, and hurried away. She had to see another guest off. When she returned, he was still lying on his back, staring upward. "What is it? Do you feel worse?" "Yes." She shook her head and sat down. "I wonder, Jean, if we shouldn't send for Leschetizky." That meant calling in the celebrated doctor, regardless of the expense. He smiled vindictively and said, "No." She sat there a while longer, then went up and kissed him on the forehead. As she was kissing him, he hated her with every inch of his being, and he had to restrain himself from pushing her away. "Good night. God willing, you'll fall asleep." "Yes." Chapter 6. Ivan Ilyich saw that he was dying, and he was in a constant state of despair. In the depth of his heart, he knew he was dying, but not only was he unaccustomed to such an idea, he simply could not grasp it at all. The syllogism he had learned from Kiesvetter's logic. Caius is a man. Men are mortal, therefore Caius is mortal. It always seemed to him correct as applied to Caius, but by no means to himself. That man, Caius, represented man in the abstract, and so the reasoning was perfectly sound. But he was not Caius, not an abstract man. He had always been a creature quite distinct from all the others. He had been little Vanya with a mama and a papa, with Mitya and Volodya, with toys, a coachman, and a nurse, and later with Katenka. Vanya, with all the joys, sorrows, and enthusiasms of his childhood, boyhood, and youth. Had Caius ever known the smell of that little striped leather ball Vanya had loved so much? Had Caius ever kissed his mother's hand so dearly, and had the silk folds of her dress ever rustled for him? Had Caius ever rioted at school when the parties were bad? Had he ever been so much in love, or presided so well over a courtroom session? Caius really was mortal, and it was only right that he should die. But for him, Vanya, Ivan Ilyich, with all his thoughts and feelings, it was something else again. And it was simply not possible that he should have to die. That would be too terrible. So his feelings went. "If I were destined to die like Caius, I would have known it," an inner voice would have told me. "But I was never aware of any such thing, and I and all my friends, we knew our situation was quite different from Caius's. Yet now look what's happened. It can't be. It just can't be. And yet it is. How is it possible? How is one to understand it?" He could not understand it and tried to dismiss the thought as false, unsound, and morbid, to force it out of his mind with other thoughts that were sound and healthy. But the thought, not just the thought, but it seemed the reality itself, kept coming back and confronting him. And one after another, in place of that thought, he called up others, hoping to find support in them. He tried to revert to a way of thinking that had obscured the thought of death from him in the past. But strangely, everything that had once obscured, hidden, obliterated the awareness of death no longer had that effect. Ivan Ilyich spent most of this latter period trying to recapture habits of feeling that had screened death from him. He would say to himself, "I'll plunge into work. After all, it was my whole life." And driving his doubts away, he would go to court, enter into conversation with his colleagues, and in his habitually distracted way, take his seat, eyeing the crowds with a pensive look, resting both his emaciated arms on those of his oaken chair, bending over, as usual, to a colleague, moving the papers over to him, exchanging remarks in a whisper, and then suddenly raising his eyes, holding himself erect, he would utter the well-known words that began the proceedings. But suddenly, in the middle of the session, the pain in his side, disregarding the stage the proceedings had reached, would begin its gnawing proceedings. Ivan Ilyich would focus on it, then try to drive the thought of it away. But the pain went right on with its work. And then it would come back and stand there and stare at him, and he would be petrified. The light would go out of his eyes. He would begin asking himself, "Can it alone be true?" And his colleagues and subordinates, amazed and distressed, saw that he who was such a brilliant, subtle judge had become confused, was making mistakes. He would rouse himself, try to regain his composure, somehow bring the session to a close, and return home sadly aware that his judicial work could no longer hide what he wanted to hide, that his judicial work could not rescue him from it. And the worst thing was that it drew his attention not so that he would do anything, but merely so that he would look at it. Look it straight in the face, and doing nothing, suffer unspeakable agony. And to escape from this situation, Ivan Ilyich sought relief, other screens. And other screens turned up, and for a while seemed to offer some escape. But then they immediately collapsed, or rather became transparent, as though it penetrated everything, and nothing could obscure it. Sometimes during this latter period, he went into the drawing room he had furnished, the very drawing room where he had fallen, for the sake of which, he would think with bitter humor, he had sacrificed his life, for he was certain that his illness had begun with that injury. He went in and saw that a deep scratch had cut through the varnished surface of a table. He tried to find the cause of the damage and discovered that the bronze ornament on an album had become bent. He picked up the album, a costly one that he had put together with loving care, and became indignant with his daughter and her friends for being so careless. In some places, the album was torn. In others, the photographs were upside down. Painstakingly, he put everything in order and bent the ornament back into place. Later on, it would occur to him to transfer the whole établissement with the albums to another corner of the room next to the plants. He would call the footman. Either his wife or daughter would come in to help. They would disagree, contradict one another. He would argue, get angry. But that was all to the good because it kept him from thinking about it. It was nowhere in sight. But when he began moving the table himself, his wife said, "Let the servants do it. You'll only hurt yourself again." And suddenly it flashed through the screen, and he saw it. It had only appeared as a flash. So he hoped it would disappear. But involuntarily he became aware of his side. The pain was still there, gnawing away at him, and he could no longer forget. It was staring at him distinctly from behind the plants. What was the point of it all? Can it be true that here, on this drapery, as at the storming of a bastion, I lost my life? How awful and how stupid. It just can't be. It can't be. Yet it is. He went to his study, lay down, and once again was left alone with it, face to face with it, unable to do anything with it, simply look at it and grow numb with horror. chapter 7. It is impossible to say how it happened, for it came about gradually, imperceptibly. But in the third month of Ivan Ilyich's illness, his wife, his daughter, his son, his acquaintances, the servants, the doctors, and above all, he himself knew that the only interest he had for others was whether he would soon vacate his place, free the living at last from the constraint of his presence and himself from his sufferings. He slept less and less. They gave him opium and began morphine injections. But this brought no relief. At the first, the muffled sense of anguish he experienced in this semi-conscious state came as a relief in that it was a new sensation. But then it became as agonizing, if not more so, than the raw pain. Special foods were prepared for him on the doctor's orders, but these became more and more unpalatable and more revolting. Special arrangements, too, were made for his bowel movements, and this was a regular torture, a torture because of the filth, the unseemliness, the stench, and the knowledge that another person had to assist in this. Yet it was precisely through this unseemly business that Ivan Ilyich derived some comfort. The pantry boy, Gerasim, always came to carry out the chamber pot. Gerasim was a clean, ruddy-faced young peasant who was thriving on town food. He was always bright and cheerful. At first, it embarrassed Ivan Ilyich to see this young fellow in his clean Russian peasant clothes performing such a revolting task. Once, when he got up from the pot too weak to draw up his trousers, he collapsed into an armchair and, horrified, gazed at his naked thighs with the muscles clearly etched on his wasted flesh. Just then, Gerasim entered the room with a light, vigorous step, exuding a pleasant smell of tar from his heavy boots in the fresh winter air. He was wearing a clean hemp apron and a clean cotton shirt with the sleeves rolled up over his strong arms. Obviously trying to suppress the joy of life that his face radiated, he thereby did not offend the sick man. He avoided looking at Ivan Ilyich and went over to get the pot. "Gerasim," said Ivan Ilyich in a feeble voice. Gerasim started, fearing he had done something wrong, and quickly turned his fresh, good-natured, simple young face, which was showing the first signs of a beard, to the sick man. "Yes, sir? This must be very unpleasant for you. You must forgive me. I can't help it." "Oh, no, sir," said Gerasim as he broke into a smile, his eyes and strong white teeth gleaming. "Why shouldn't I help you? You're a sick man." And with strong, deft hands, he performed his usual task, walking out of the room with a light step. 5 minutes later, with just as light a step, he returned. Ivan Ilyich was still sitting in the armchair in the same position. "Gerasim," he said, when the latter had replaced the freshly washed pot, "please come and help me." Gerasim went over to him. "Lift me up. It's hard for me to get up, and I've sent Dmitri away." Gerasim took hold of him with his strong arms and with a touch as light as a step, deftly, gently lifted and supported him with one hand, while with the other he pulled up his trousers. He was about to set him down again, but Ivan Ilyich asked that he help him over to the sofa. With no effort and no apparent pressure, Gerasim led, almost carried him, to the sofa and seated him there. "Thank you. How skillfully, how well you do everything." Gerasim smiled again and turned to leave, but Ivan Ilyich felt so good with him there that he was reluctant to have him go. "Oh, one more thing. Please move that chair over here. No, the other one, to put under my feet. I feel better with my legs raised." Gerasim carried the chair over and in one smooth motion set it down gently in place and lifted Ivan Ilyich's legs onto it. It seemed to Ivan Ilyich that he felt better when Gerasim lifted his legs up. "I feel better with my legs raised," said Ivan Ilyich. "Bring that pillow over and put it under them." Gerasim did so. He lifted his legs up again and placed the pillow under them. Again, Ivan Ilyich felt better when Gerasim raised his legs. When he let them down, he seemed to feel worse. "Gerasim," he said, "are you busy now?" "Not at all, sir," said Gerasim, who had learned from the working people in town how to speak to the masters. "What else do you have to do?" "What else? I've done everything except chop wood for tomorrow." Then could you hold my legs up a bit higher? Why, of course I can. Gerasim lifted his legs higher, and it seemed to Ivan Ilyich that in this position he felt no pain at all. But what about the firewood? Don't worry yourself about it, sir. I'll get it done. Ivan Ilyich had Gerasim sit down and hold his legs up, and he began talking to him. And, strangely enough, he thought he felt better while Gerasim was holding his legs. After that, Ivan Ilyich would send for Gerasim from time to time and have him hold his feet on his shoulders, and he loved to talk to him. Gerasim did everything easily, willingly, simply, and with a goodness of heart that moved Ivan Ilyich. Health, strength, and vitality in other people offended Ivan Ilyich, whereas Gerasim's strength and vitality had a soothing effect on him. Ivan Ilyich suffered most of all from the lie which, for some reason, everyone accepted, that he was not dying, but was simply ill, and that if he stayed calm and underwent treatment, he could expect good results. Yet he knew that regardless of what was done, all he could expect was more agonizing suffering and death. And he was tortured by this lie, tortured by the fact that they refused to acknowledge what he and everyone else knew, that they wanted to lie about his horrible condition and to force him to become a party to that lie. This lie, a lie perpetuated on the eve of his death, a lie that was bound to degrade the awesome, solemn act of his dying to the level of their social calls, their draperies, and the sturgeon they ate for dinner, was an excruciating truth for Ivan Ilyich. And, oddly enough, many times when they were going through their acts with him, he came within a hairbreadth of shouting, "Stop your lying! You and I know that I am dying, so at least stop lying." But he never had the courage to do it. He saw the awesome, terrifying act of his dying had been degraded by those about him to the level of a chance unpleasantness, a bit of unseemly behavior. They reacted to him as they would to a man who emitted a foul odor on entering a drawing room. That it had been degraded by that very propriety to which he had devoted his entire life. He saw that no one pitied him because no one even cared to understand his situation. Gerasim was the only one who understood and pitied him, and for that reason, Ivan Ilyich felt comfortable only with Gerasim. It was a comfort to him when Gerasim sat with him sometimes the whole night through, holding his legs, refusing to go to bed, saying, "Don't worry, Ivan Ilyich, I'll get a good sleep later on." Or when he suddenly addressed him in the familiar form and said, "It would be a different thing if you weren't sick, but as it is, why shouldn't I do a little extra work?" Gerasim was the only one who did not lie. Everything he did showed that he alone understood what was happening, saw no need to conceal it, and simply pitied his feeble, wasted master. Once, as Ivan Ilyich was sending him away, he came right out and said, "We all have to die sometime, so why shouldn't I help you?" By this he meant that he did not find his work a burden because he was doing it for a dying man, and he hoped that someone would do the same for him when his time came. In addition to the lie, or owing to it, what tormented Ivan Ilyich most was that no one gave him the kind of compassion he craved. There were moments after long suffering when what he wanted most of all, shameful as it might be for him to admit, was to be pitied like a sick child. He wanted to be caressed, kissed, cried over, as sick children are caressed and comforted. He knew that he was an important functionary with a graying beard, and so this was impossible. Yet all the same, he longed for it. There was something approaching this in his relationship with Gerasim, and so the relationship was a comfort to him. Ivan Ilyich wanted to cry, wanted to be caressed and cried over. Yet his colleague, Shebek, a member of the court, would come, and instead of crying and getting some affection, Ivan Ilyich would assume a serious, stern, profound expression, and by force of habit, offer his opinion about a decision by the Court of Appeals and stubbornly defend it. Nothing did so much to poison the last days of Ivan Ilyich's life as this falseness in himself and in those around him. You've been listening to The Death of Ivan Ilyich by Count Leo Tolstoy. This is Mike Ailman. Thanks so much for listening, and good night.